everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. It is Brandon Odo back with Brian Bowling.
Hello, everybody.
And we got lightning rounds, and we are, I think we've sort of unintentionally developed this as a theme lately, but we've been trying to sort of take a look at some of the other, the different roles and positions that sort of surround what we do. And one entire profession that we have completely neglected, like we never had a guest, and I don't think we've really ever even talked about it much, is respiratory therapy, which is really something we work with hand in hand in critical care, at least in this country. Really a sort of a fundamental part of what we do, and when it comes to things like managing ventilators and patients with respiratory failure. So we thought it would be worth just exploring what that's all about, what the job is like, how we can work better with these folks. And no one better to help us with it than Keith Lamb, who we have with us today. Keith is a respiratory therapist with, I think 26 years now of experience. He works down at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville in critical care, mostly trauma, surgical, neuro. But he's held a variety of leadership positions there. He's very involved with Society of Critical Care Medicine, research, and other leadership initiatives. So a busy guy, and probably the perfect person to, represent this field. And Brian's going to MC us a little bit and explore it.
All right. Hey, Keith, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Brian. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So no pressure. We've just asked you to represent every respiratory therapist across the United States and around the world throughout time. What do you guys do? No, I'm just kidding.
I just forgot I had to be somewhere.
So I think most of us work with respiratory therapists pretty regularly, like Brandon said, at least in the States. I don't know how prevalent the profession is outside of the United States.
So there are respiratory therapists in China, and some of Europe, in Australia, but South America, most of South America utilize physiotherapists that sort of are trained, more broadly.
Well, so most of us, work with respiratory therapists, or RT, as we typically call you guys, every day in the ICU, and we know you as the folks who do the vent stuff and the folks who do the NEB stuff. But let's talk a little bit about more what your real role is, and what do you guys do in the ICU?
So I think like Brandon alluded to, I have held roles as ECMO director, ECMO coordinator, critical care coordinator, research coordinator, et cetera. But on a very basic level, entry level, a respiratory therapist has a pretty strong background in cardiopulmonary physiology. And, their role, sort of like anybody else in the ICU, varies based on location and sort of culture. So I can describe what a respiratory therapist does at University of Virginia. We come in and we get sign out just like you guys do, from nighttime person. And we take that sign out information and sort of formulate a plan for each individual patient. And then we start to implement that plan. And then, as you both know, multidisciplinary rounds are probably the most important part of the day, where everybody sort of gets on the same page and continues the plan of the day. But a respiratory therapist will come in, get sign out. They'll go and prioritize, because, just like you guys, something may happen acutely that just sort of ties you up for an hour or 2 hours, some sort of emergent issue. So we certainly come in and prioritize and triage our plan based on acuity level of each patient. Just because a patient's intubated, that might not be the most acute, the patient that needs to be seen first. It might be that person that's not intubated yet, that has flail chest, that needs some sort of, chest physiotherapy or volume expansion or all those things that we do. So we prioritize, then build our plan, and then come back together and and rounds and solidify the total plan.
Besides, you know, the guy who tweaks the vent and does the nubs, you mentioned chest physiotherapy. What are some other things that that RTs do in the ICU and that we can maybe better utilize you guys for?
So as you both know, you know, there's not a lot of robust evidence for most of the things that either one of us do. And so we sort of have to sort that out. And I can tell you that I honestly spent a lot of time getting rid of things that aren't indicated, as well as implementing things that are. But some of the things that we do, you know, I work in a trauma ICU, and the great majority of the patients that I take care of have chest trauma. So we spend a lot of time providing volume expansion therapy, maybe some positive expiratory pressure therapy, and just coaching. You know, there's no evidence to support the use of an incentive spirometer. I can't remember how much those things cost right now, but there's no evidence to support that they change outcomes in any way whatsoever. However, you know, being in front of the patient and coaching them and explaining to them that they need to cough and deep breathe and to ambulate when somebody asks them to, you know, takes a lot of our time and certainly does have some efficacy.
What's it like schooling wise? Like, how do you become a respiratory therapist? What's the training like?
So some of it parallels the nursing profession in that you still can get at this, you know, in 2024, you still can get your respiratory therapy degree in 2 years at an associate's program. However, there are many, many BS degrees now, master's programs, and even PhD programs. So entry-level respiratory therapist is 2 years at an associate's degree school. But most people at this, in this day and age, most people who get their associate's degree work towards expanding into the BS, a BS program somewhere.
And what's that training like? Like, what do you?
Anatomy and physiology, pharmacology, pathophysiology, you know, all the things that that most clinicians go through at the beginning of their education. And then we have a fairly robust clinical rotation requirement, no matter what kind of program you're in.
What about like advanced skills and stuff that RTs do? Some RTs intubate, some place A-lines.
Right, and again, that sort of varies. Like where I trained in Delaware at Christiana, 1,300-bed, you know, tertiary center, level one trauma, level four nursery, et cetera. We did not have an anesthesia residency there, so we were responsible for all intubations outside of the operating room, or outside the emergency department. So, you know, in the 14 years I was there, I intubated 4, 5, 6 people a week, and so I personally have intubated more than 3,000 people. There are some RTs that have never intubated outside of their clinical rotations. Where I trained, we put A lines in, and there are some places that they utilize. It depends on, you know, the acuity level of the place you're at and sort of the census. But when I ran the ECMO program out in Iowa, my specialists, who were about half RNs and half RTs, also placed all the midlines in the hospital. You know, so there's out of necessity, you know, some places your scope will expand or change based on like at UVA, we have an anesthesia residency, we have anesthesia fellowship. In the 4 years that I've been at University of Virginia, I probably have intubated 4 people. You know, I've backed up people that were having trouble and helped teach airway management. But
is it fair to say that the respiratory therapist will usually take a more expanded role in some of these things at smaller, less resourced places? They're kind of filling in that gap that you would not, might be filled by residents, fellows, other trainees, and so on at bigger, more academic places.
Yeah, that's fair to say.
Yeah, I know. I was surprised. I originally trained at a big academic center, and then my first nursing job was at a small community hospital. And we had a patient who was not doing well, and you know, the attending physician is standing right there, this is screaming, "This patient needs to be intubated." And I kept thinking, like, "Well, get to it." And you know, and then the respiratory therapist comes in, goes to the head of the bed, intubates the patient, and I was like, "What's happening?" Like, this is not what I'm used to, right? Like, So you guys learn intubations in school. Do you learn ALINs? Is every RT learning how to do that in school, or is that kind of an on the job thing? Or
that's sort of an on the job thing. I think, you know, most RT programs have clinical rotations where the RT student will go to the operating room on a controlled setting and intubate under the, you know, supervision of an anesthesiologist. And most students go through that. I would go out on a limb and say most students never put an A-line in. They may put, they may put peripheral IVs in. Mm-hmm. Most of us have done that, but it's usually on the job sort of training. You know, it was sort of funny because where I trained, I was responsible for the intubation, EKGs, phlebotomy, obviously ABGs, and airway management. So if I went to a code or something, and intubated somebody and got ROSC, then I would have to do the EKG. I'd have to draw blood for, you know, phlebotomy and then do an ABG. And
it sounds like to have this much flexibility, the laws and policies and protocols and all the regulatory things for respiratory therapists must be kind of flexible. I mean, does it say something like, you know, your scope of practice is something like vascular interventions or something like that, and then it's up to the institution to decide what that means?
Yeah, it's very vague. You know, it's very vague. All states in the United States have a licensure act and require license for respiratory therapists to practice, except for Alaska. And they're working on it as we speak. But yeah, the licensure laws are written in a way that allows some flexibility.
Well, it sounds very, like we talked about, you know, nursing regulations in the past. It sort of sounds like the opposite. That tend to be very clear cut. Yeah. Like you can do this, that, and the other, and nothing else. Yeah.
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 Yeah. And it's interesting you bring up doing EKGs, because the RTs do EKGs where I am now. And this is the first place I've ever worked that's the case. And I thought, weird. But that's something that's not just a weird oddity of where I work now. That's something that RTs do a lot of places.
Most of these things, as you know, are sort of decided by people who don't take care of patients. They have a clipboard and a pencil, and they have a calculator in there. You know, we're down to four phlebotomists for night times. How are we going to RT? You know, that's how these things happen. And another thing that sort of determines practice pattern, practice abilities, is autonomy and rapport with the team, right? So there's a high variability, quality of education, quality of experience, quality of training. You know, not all RTs are created equal, just like not all MPs or PAs are created equal. And so I think that if you develop the rapport and the trust with the team, we have what's called an advanced practice RT now, who have prescriptive authority and all the things that they need to practice at that level. And we have two of them that have jobs, and they both work for the VA in Washington, D.C. now.
Like there's two in the country, you're saying?
Yeah, so it's a new, you know, it's a new thing. And there's been a lot of uphill, as you might imagine, just like there was in both of your professions at some point in time. You know, there was, you know, why do we need EPAs? Why do we need nurse practitioners? Well, why do we need advanced practice RT? And so those people who asked those questions, you know, have given us a hard time. But it's fine. We have a couple of programs in the country that a couple of universities have this program, I don't know how many graduates there are, but I'm acutely aware of how many actually have jobs.
What sort of role are they envisioned as filling?
So I think that I got to tell you that I'm on the board of directors of the ARC, and I sort of have to stay neutral in terms of what I can say and what I can't say. So this is my personal opinion, and I'll tell you that I can't see them doing your job. I do see there being a need in the VA, for instance, where you have a lot of veterans that come in and need smoking cessation, and they need better control of their COPD medicines, and they need, you know, just better access to those things that they may have a hard time getting a hold of. So I think that's right now what the primary role is and where they're fitting in. I don't know where it'll lead. I do know both of the people that have gotten jobs. And I know that, that their training did include, you know, central line placement and chest tube placement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know RTs that put in chest tubes that are on transport teams. But that's not the norm.
Yeah. We recently talked about flight medicine, on another episode and talked about how some models fly a nurse and a respiratory therapist. So there's certainly other opportunities outside of what we traditionally in the ICU see for you guys in your roles. But you mentioned ECMO specialists and you were the director of an ECMO program. What's the role of the RT in terms of providing care for ECMO patients?
Most models today sort of try to mimic an RT-RN ECMO specialist model. Perfusionists are too expensive. And I think that, you know, if I'm having open heart surgery, which I did about almost 3 years ago, I want a perfusionist, but they're not critical care experts. You know, they don't know the nuances of ICU care, and they're not intimately familiar for the most part with ventilator management. And the nurse ECMO specialist and the RT ECMO specialist bring something to the table.
It sounds like respiratory therapists are... they fill a very kind of utility role in a lot of places in that they can kind of be trained or implemented to fill different needs. In many ways, probably, I mean, nurses are flexible as well. People can kind of do what they need to do with them. But one of the big differences is just that nurses have already become so overloaded that systems are looking for someone who didn't seem quite as busy. And they're like, maybe the respiratory therapist can do the EKGs now.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I think I agree with 100%.
Does there tend to be, you know, you finish your initial respiratory therapy training, you're certified, does there tend to be additional specialization that occurs after that, whether it's some sort of formal postgraduate training or people just tend to get into certain areas? Or if you are covering a shift, is it like you could be in the ICU or you could be anywhere sort of thing?
It's highly variable amongst institutions as well. You know, there are a lot of RT residencies popping up around the country now because we've identified a gap in education for particularly critical care. RT is one of the few professions that you graduate from school, you take your board exam to be a registered respiratory therapist, and then the next day you could be in the ICU without ever really having any formal critical care training other than the clinical rotations you had in school. So sort of as a result of that, we've had additional board exams become available to us. That, you know, there's one for adults, the adult critical care specialist exam, neonatal pediatrics, and there are a handful of others that specialize in pulmonary function testing and asthma education, et cetera. But you come into work, and when you're a brand new RT, you come in and you look at the assignment board, and you could be anywhere. You could be in the emergency department. You could be in one of the ICUs. You could be, you know, in PEDS or the neonatal ICU. Now, I will tell you that a lot of places, like at the University of Virginia, have services. And I work on the trauma, neurosurgical, and surgical critical care service. So when I come in, I take care of surgical and trauma ICU patients almost exclusively. But it's not like that. It's not like that everywhere.
So we mentioned a couple of times this RT ECMO specialist role. Surely there's extra training involved with that. How does that work?
Many places have their own in-house sort of training program. And some people use some of the commercially available training platforms, companies that provide ECMO training. That's what we did in Iowa. You train people so that they're interchangeable. Like the RT can give blood, the RT can titrate heparin, the RT can do anything that as an ECMO specialist that the RN ECMO specialist can do.
So, you know, it sounds like the RT role in general is a lot like nursing in that, like Brandon was mentioning, you're sort of trained as a generalist. You may specialize, but depending on the hospital you work for, the higher ups may have more or less respect for that specialization. I know nurses often are, you know, floated from unit to unit with really little regard to the fact that, you know, maybe I've spent you know, 10 years of my life learning to do open heart surgery recovery. And now I'm asked to do like, you know, post ortho surgery or something that I've never done before. And also a little bit in that utility role of, like you said, hey, we need somebody to do this. Who's available? I hate to come back to the EKG thing, but it just still baffles me. Like the phlebotomy kind of makes sense because you guys draw ABGs in patients that don't have A-lines, but the EKG thing has always baffled me. It just seems to have like no tie-in whatsoever to your training or your role. It just, like you said, it seems to be like, hey, we need somebody to do EKGs. Who's not busy?
You know what's next to the lungs? The heart.
Yeah, right. It's pretty close.
Maybe
yeah.
You guys can place Dopoff tubes too. The esophagus runs right behind the trachea.
Work your way down. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it does feel like you guys have, and maybe it's like you said, your training is a little general. Your practice act is fairly vague. Is this the beginning of the world takeover of RTs? They're just going to start doing everything. And am I out of a job soon? Like
very, very unlikely. I don't think that most RTs want to do everything. The RT really should be the expert with the ventilator and the ICU. And most often that's the case. And we're trying to make that the case all the time.
Well, let me ask you about that. Cause I want to be like, totally transparent about it, that, you know, probably, I don't think I'm an argumentative person, but respiratory therapy is probably the role that I feel like I've gotten into more arguments with during critical care than any other. And I think it tends to come down to what you were kind of touching on, that the variability in this position in terms of knowledge, training, experience is high. And this applies to plenty of other things, but, and what that often means is that it's easy to work with experts, and it's honestly easier to work with people with a smaller knowledge base who are like comfortable with that. Like, you know, write the order, I'll put it in, no sweat. It's challenging to work with people who have a relatively small knowledge base and a great deal of confidence in their knowledge. And you get into a lot of arguments about things like ventilator strategies or respiratory physiology, and they can be like the sort of argument that I don't know how to make progress on. Like it's just coming from such a radically different understanding of like how human bodies work. Like I've had, you know, conversations about like, why is this patient with metabolic acidosis? Why are we inducing this respiratory alkalosis? It doesn't make any sense. And it's just like such a fundamental like concept in physiology that like, I don't know that you can like hold a lecture about it, which seems a little condescending and is, you know, perhaps not something you have time for and so on. So I guess I don't know what the best strategy for this sort of thing is. And maybe there is no strategy. This is just what happens when you have a profession with that sort of variability. But I have found it to be challenging at times. What do you think?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's nothing you said that I could possibly argue with. I see it all the time. I see it every day. You know, I think our role, your role, Brian's role, my role is to teach. And I do the best that I can. I think that we all do. I think the most dangerous person in the ICU is the person you described that has a very limited understanding of the physiology and the current practice and the evidence but has a fairly robust confidence level. As being the old man, the pop-up in the ICU RT world where I work, I find that I have a pretty easy time stepping in front of that bullet.
It's like the old man privilege.
Yeah, old man. He's old and grumpy. Don't argue with him. You know, there's a reason why he's lived so long. Brandon, it's a problem. And I think that you both would agree that, that neither one of you are the standard clinician either, right? There's certainly nurse practitioners and PAs that know very little about the ventilator, and would consult me on a regular basis. You know, there's nothing you said that I could possibly, disagree with. And I spend a great majority of my time, on the whiteboard in the middle of the ICU, on the little whiteboards in the rooms, teaching the RT, hey, you know, you can't do an RSBI on pressure support of 10 over 10. You know, that's not what the data, that's not how the data was collected. You're using this number to support your decision to do the spontaneous breathing trial, whether or not that's a whole different topic, whether or not that number should be used at all for anything. But if you're going to use that number and you're going to quote that 105, then you have to, it has to be done on no support. That's the way that data was collected. It was done with a spirometer hooked up to the ET tube. It wasn't done on a ventilator with, you know, pressure support and trying to, so that on a very basic level, that's something that we have to address in the ICU with junior clinicians daily.
It seems like a lot of it must be cultural, right? Like, you know, my prior field was in EMS, and I think there was a lot of the same challenges where there's just a huge variation in levels of expertise. But it almost seems like unrelated to that is how people sort of perceive it. And I guess willingness to learn. And there, the culture was, there's a lot of people who are very sort of confident in what they do. And you wonder where that sort of culture arises from. And there, I think a lot of it was, first of all, there is a lot of independence. People are out on their own. They're not like working with people a lot. There's frankly no one there often to like tell them that they have it wrong. But a lot of it also, I think, is that it's people don't perceive their job as being highly respected. So part of what they do to carve that space out is to have that confidence in what they're doing, rightly or wrongly.
And they're the reason why they're not respected, right? There's always one, right, that has been doing this EMS stuff since they were 16, and they know everything. You know, you have to remember that some of these people that are graduating from some of these different areas of expertise spent their whole clinical career so far during the pandemic. And some of them have never even touched a patient before because they would go to their clinical rotations and they say, oh, don't go in there. The guy's got COVID. We don't want you to get sick. And so I had a brand new graduate RT a few weeks ago that came in, and I asked them to go in and see this patient. I said, don't do anything. Just go in, see the patient, look at the patient, look at the ventilator. I want you to measure a plateau pressure, and I want you to calculate the driving pressure, and I want you to look at the vital signs, all that stuff. This person looked at me and was like, I can't go in there. I've never done any of that before. And this is a person who has graduated from an RT program, has sat and taken the first level boards. There's just so many different levels of disparity.
Yeah, and no doubt the best way to make those like confidence and competence curves match up is by raising up the level of competence, right? Not by knocking everyone down a peg. And I know that, you know, there's places with, you know, super strong respiratory departments where they really are kind of the managers of things like mechanical ventilation, and the medical teams are maybe involved in one or two of these sort of high level decisions based on the overall arc of care, but the RTs are really managing everything else. And that's just sort of seen as their role and they're up to it. And I mean, that sounds phenomenal. I would say by and large, that's not the sorts of systems that I've worked in. And I'm sure you have to cultivate that sort of thing. You need to train people and retain people and have kind of appropriate expectations. And there's a lot that goes into that, but it makes a lot of sense because, to be completely honest, not that many people really understand mechanical ventilation. And if anyone is going to, you guys are probably best suited to, especially the practicalities. And I think people on our side understand that, like, we're not going to have a great sense for, like, you know, changing out the circuits and troubleshooting every alarm and stuff like that. But I mean, also, how many of us are going to really understand, you know, diagnosing vent asynchronies and things like that? I mean, not very many, and not necessarily that all the therapists will either, but probably you guys have a better chance of it than we do. You have more of that hands-on experience. You have a better opportunity to develop this sort of expertise and to, you know, get the patients that sort of understanding rather than all of us standing at arm's length and being like, you know, I don't know, this patient's being weird or something like that.
You know, about 10 years ago or so, I visited Prague. They were graduating their first class of respiratory therapists. They take PhD biomedical engineers, right, who know everything about how the ventilator could possibly work. And then they teach them the clinical stuff. Boy, wouldn't it be nice if everybody knew as much about the stuff as they're supposed to know?
That would be an expert. Yeah. There's no black boxes then. Yeah.
That's the expert. Yeah. That's the expert. Oh yeah, I know. And so when I was there, we did some animal lab stuff. We did an oscillator study, like acid ARDS, and they had real time echo, and we had this animal on an oscillator, and you could see what the right heart does when you get up to a certain mean airway pressure. The oscillator, you can't measure tidal volumes on. So then way back when we started to really think about tidal volumes, the Czechs, they just built a machine that would measure the tidal volume. China, same sort of thing. I traveled to Shanghai, and they're all critical care nurses first. So they take a critical care nurse, and then they just teach them the respiratory stuff.
Part of me feels like it's in the ideal world. I mean, you could imagine a world without respiratory therapists managing ventilators, for instance. And when you add these roles, ideally it would mean that it's adding to the overall mix. We're adding additional levels of specialization. But in practice, I think a lot of time when we add specialty roles, it's subtracting. Someone else says, oh, I don't have to worry about that anymore. Mm-hmm. And then you're assuming that this new person not only could fill in the whole gap, but hopefully still add something to it. When in practice, I mean, we're lucky if we end up at the same place, which is a shame. And we should not be going, oh, they'll handle the vent, and you know, pharmacy will handle the dosing, nursing will handle everything else, and then I'll write the note or something.
Yeah, obviously, in a perfect world, everybody will have the same interest. You know, when I go see a patient, one of the first things I do besides look at the patient is go over and look to see what they're on for IV drips. You know, if somebody's a TBI and they're on 20 of midazolam an hour, they're on 500 of fentanyl. You know, it's important for the RT to understand what that means.
What do you think, you know, at not just for us, I guess, but for all of our ilk, how could we better support what you guys are doing and interact with you? Because, I mean, obviously some of the things we've been talking about, just the understanding each other's roles is important, but you know, whether practical things or more fundamental things, you know, how could we be doing this relationship a little better?
Man, I'm so lucky that I work in a place where, you know, I go in to see patients, and then by the time rounds happens, the team would be disappointed in me if I hadn't already done whatever needed to be done, right? If I didn't already do an SPT, or if I didn't already make ventilator changes that were appropriate, they would be disappointed. But I don't like we've sort of expanded on here multiple times now. It's not the same everywhere. But so if you work in a place where your RTs may be not practicing at the top of their capabilities or what you need them to do, then to sort of gently bring them up to speed so that you can work in tandem. You know, I think what you said, Brandon, is really important in that it's our job to educate. It's not our job to bring those super confident people that maybe shouldn't be down, because anybody can do that. And very few RTs would appreciate the NP or the PA schooling them on how to manage the ventilator. Whether or not they're right or they're wrong, right? Touch base with somebody who can speak their language and help them understand what they need to understand. You know, most big departments have a fairly robust educator that should be involved in this.
And I'm sure, as a general rule, it's probably helpful when we could try to minimize the amount of pointless stuff you guys are doing. You talked about trying to get rid of just nonsense like nebulizers people don't need or chest PT, and I'm sure that's always appreciated, both to give you guys back time in your day, but also I think it just has an impact on everyone when they're doing stuff they know is pointless. It sort of sends a message that like it's an increasing percentage of the work you do is not contributory. It's so getting rid of things can be as effective at like improving that percentage as adding other things, you know?
Yeah. You know, a lot of places have algorithms and protocols that allow them to get rid of things that aren't necessary, but a lot of places don't. And so the people are just bogged down with doing nip treatments on everybody in the hospital. Giving the RTs a little bit of autonomy and leeway to get rid of things that all these things have some, they may not be significant risk, but all of them mm-hmm. have some risk. You know, I years ago we did a quality improvement sort of thing where I trained and they, somebody built this brand new order set. They just had a box you could check off for a CombiVent, 8 puffs CombiVent. And somebody was just checking these CombiVent things off on everybody who was intubated. And so I did some chart review and realized, gosh, it's unbelievable how much money that costs. First of all, just for the product, not counting that if the RT is actually waiting the amount of time between puffs that they're supposed to be waiting, the hours and days that they spend doing these CombiVent, and then potassium replacement because they were making everybody hypokalemic with Q4, 8 puffs of their, are these unintended consequences of doing things that aren't necessary. Even if the risk is very small, mm-hmm. there is some risk. If there's no benefit, then you shouldn't be doing it. So on our patients, if a patient's getting an aerosolized medicine, our patients, we have these HMEs that you rotate. And when you're given an aerosolized med, you rotate so that the medicine goes through and doesn't get stuck in the HME. And, everybody always forgets to turn the thing back onto HME after the treatment, right? Because you start this aerosolized treatment on somebody and then you go do something else and you go do something else and somebody calls you for something and it's time to round. And 2 hours later, you go back, you finally remember that this person's not really getting any humidity. It doesn't matter how much experience you have. It's really difficult to make that happen appropriately. And so probably 6 hours of the day, this patient that's intubated is not getting any form of humidity. You know, it's just an unintended consequence of writing an order for something that didn't need to be given to begin with.
I think a lot of it just comes down, like we've said, to just teamwork and respecting other people's roles and knowledge. And I think the more you work with people, you know, like a good nurse, we say a good nurse can make your day and a bad nurse can break your day. And I think the same thing with RTs, right? Very often we'll be in the unit going through and I'll see a patient that's having some sort of issue and ask the nurse, you know, hey, who's your RT today? And, you know, there's certain names that when I hear them, I'm like, okay, good. I can kind of turn this off because I know they're going to be on top of it. And I'll go talk to them and be like, hey, here's the issue. You know, what do you think? And sometimes I've got one RT who'll just say, we'll take care of it. And I go, okay, that's all I need to hear because I know I can put that trust in, right? You know, RTs, when I was a brand new nurse, taught me a lot about the ventilator and how to read ABGs. And then I've been at places where, you know, I'll say, what do you think about this? And I get blank stares and they go, I mean, do you want me to turn the rate up? Well, I'm asking what you think, right? Well, I mean, I can turn the rate up if you want. Okay.
Yeah, you can tell a lot by asking somebody what they think.
Yeah. So I think the other thing I would say from our side of things is I appreciate when people come to me with things like, you know, like you were saying, I'm doing all this useless stuff. And I find that, right, that, you know, we've got people that are doing useless things, but nobody ever comes and tells me, hey, this is useless that I'm doing. You know, and I know, you know, maybe it's because the last time you told somebody that you got yelled at or whatever, but I always appreciate when I get that feedback from nurses too, right? I'll find that out. Like, you know, the nurses will tell me something like, oh, I did this all day yesterday. Well, why didn't you say something? I would have stopped that. Right. Like, so I think communication is just really important.
Yeah. Communication. I know it sounds cliche, but.
Well, I think this has been, it's been really instructive, I think, for me. And hopefully for some listeners too, to just hear kind of, you know, what you guys do in your side of things. Anything else that you want us to know about the RTs and what they do in the ICU and how they can do it better and how we can help with that?
I would encourage people to approach you. Some people, I would just make sure that, cause not everybody knows that. Right. And I think that, just making sure that you have that relationship with your RT and,
All right. Well, I think that we'll leave it there. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And as always, Keith mentioned this a little bit, but it bears repeating. Everything we've said today is our own personal opinion. Doesn't represent any organizations that we either work for or are on the board of or represent in any other way. And of course, as always, this shouldn't be construed as medical advice. Hopefully you're getting some education from other places as well. So thanks a lot, and we'll catch you next time.